Well, the commentator Tremper Longman calls the chapter we're looking at today, he calls it clearly the most pessimistic and the most depressing of the entire book. So get ready. And the preacher does, I mean, he forces us once again, but in a more intense way, even in this chapter, to look at the hard realities of life under the sun. And he pulls no punches. But at the same time, I don't think he leaves us in the dark. I don't know that I would call it the most depressing. In fact, he balances his pessimism with optimism and a lot of joy and uplifting perspective on our life. Yes, even our life under the sun. When I was a kid, elementary school, I remember I used to like these little books called Encyclopedia Brown. I don't know if any of y'all ever read Encyclopedia Brown. And delightful little books. Some of y'all have. And you could pick up clues through the chapter and figure out who did something, stole the cookies or something like that. And you read it. It was clean, simple, you solved the riddle, you tied it up in a bow, and it was done. And, you know, we can view life that way. We kind of want to view life that way. It's neat, clean, clear, simple, get a motto, you figured it out, there's no more mystery, you've solved the riddle, let go, let God, faith, family, fun, what would Jesus do? It's all fine, it's just that life is more complex. And it can be just overwhelming. And Solomon, or the preacher, he expresses this. He will say simple things. We're going to get there, but he keeps circling around and coming back and hitting things again and wrestling and struggling and dealing with the mystery and the why and going back to big questions. You know, it's when something difficult has happened, if you're burdened with something, if you're dealing with grief, that's how you work through it. And it seems that not only is he an older man who's been through a lot that's discipling younger people, but he himself is continuing to work through the complexity, the bewilderment, the crushing nature in so many ways of this world. It reminds me of my mother when, 20 years ago, when my brother died, and we were just overwhelmed, and I would keep going home. And I knew, I kind of dreaded it, but I knew that when I went home, at some point she'd sit me down in a chair and she would ask again, but where was God that night when your brother gave in to depression? Where was he? And in one sense, you know, you wait, you sit, because it's just grief. On another event, she wanted to know, so she would ask the question again, and you go back to the character of God and the promises of God, but you keep working through it. And Solomon's doing this. It's real life. And so Philip Ryken has a wonderful thing to say. He goes, it helps us understand what kind of book we're dealing with. Not the kind you keep reading until you reach the end and then you get the answer like a mystery novel, but a book with which you keep struggling and struggling with the problems of life. But as you struggle, you learn to trust God with the questions even when you don't have the answers. And this too is how the Christian life works. It's not just about what we get in the end, but what we become along the way. Y'all, that's awesome. And we're invited in, like he's discipling us, but we're invited into the preacher's process. And we're asked to engage the questions head on. And as we do so, we do heart work wrestling with God and change and growth happens. I love that. And so, again, just to say where we are, chapters 1 through 6, the emphasis is on the meaning of life. And then the second half, chapter 7 through 12, focuses on, okay, given that's the meaning of life, how then do we live wisely in this world under the sun? So we've dealt with chapter 7 and 8 in this second half, and we've talked about the practical usefulness of wisdom. We've talked about its leverage and limitations, you know, the advantages you have by being wise, but also there's limits. And then we said what it can do and what it can't do. Chapter 9 grows out of that. But in chapter 9, as I think about it, it's like chapter 9 goes back to the big questions. Because again, that's what you do. And he's going back to the big questions, and he's setting forth what a wise life entails before the hard realities of life in this fallen world. So chapter 9, let's read. Verse 1, but all this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. Whether it is love or hate, man does not know, both are before him. It is the same for all, since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As the good one is, so is the sinner, and he who swears is as he who shuns an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that the same event happens to all. Also, the hearts of the children of man are full of evil, and madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. But he who is joined with all the living has hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Their love and their hate and their envy have already perished, and forever they have no more share in all that is done under the sun. Go, eat your bread with joy. And drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Let your garments be always white. Let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life that he has given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might, for there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going. Again, I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor the bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge, but time and chance happen to them all. For man does not know his time. Like fish that are taken in an evil net, and like birds that are caught in a snare, so the children of man are snared in an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. I've also seen this example of wisdom under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with a few men in it, and a great king came against it and besieged it, building great siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor wise man. And he, by his wisdom, delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that poor man. But I say that wisdom is better than might, though the poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heard. The words of the wise, heard in quiet, are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. And the grass withers and the flowers fade. And this good word for you today endures forever. And we can count on it. Thanks be to God. So 3 points. The struggle over what you can depend on, verse 1-6. The struggle over what you can depend on. Then second, the struggle over what you can't depend on, verses 11-18. And then sandwiched in the middle, the significance of what you do right now, verse 7-10. So first, the struggle over what you can depend on. All right, so as we ended up chapter 4, in verse 17, the preacher acknowledges that everything that goes on in life under the sun is, notice that phrase, the work of God. It's all the work of God. It's all under God's sovereign government. Nothing slips out of his sovereign government. Yet the way God governs this world baffles him, the preacher, and baffles us oftentimes. I'm sure in your life, you've asked, where's the good in this plan? So the preacher wears himself out, poring over providence, staying up all night trying to unlock the mysteries, but he gets nowhere because that's really not the path of wisdom. J.I. Packer would even say, most occurrences under the sun bear no outward sign of a rational, moral God ordering them all. That's a strong statement. I mean, this is the world where a Black Hawk helicopter on a training run collides with a civilian American Airlines jet that has 60 passengers. Out of nowhere. And we could get angry and bitter and deny there's even a God. How could he if he's sovereignly in charge? Yet notice that the preacher does not do this. With all his questions and frustrations, he doesn't go there. He stares at life under the sun, square in the face. And then he declares in chapter 9, verse 1, but all this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. And Philip Ryken again says it well. The preacher isn't exuding loving devotion here, but his faith is prevailing. And that's really solid, and that's where we can sometimes be. He's working through it in faith. He believes God's got the whole world in his hands. And especially that he really does hold in his hands the righteous and the wise and their deeds in his hands. And what is something bedrock we can count on, come what may, is that God holds us and all we do in his hands and we can depend upon it. What's something you can depend on? Depend on that you're held in the hands of God. And it fills us with immeasurable comfort, even when I don't understand. We're held, we know better than Solomon or the preacher, we're held in nail-pierced hands. If we suffer, he suffered infinitely more. But you see, we know more than the preacher does. For his part, no sooner does he profess this truth than he then expresses insecurity. What is that insecurity? Whether it is love or hate, man does not know, both are before him. So what's unsettling the preacher? Well, it's this love or hate. And this love or hate refers to God. It's God's disposition towards him as he holds him in his hand, the righteous, the wise, and their deeds. though he would affirm he's in the hand of God, he wonders, in what condition am I? Love or hate is a Hebrew way of speaking of God's acceptance or rejection. Remember Romans 9. Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. He accepted one and rejected the other. I may be in his hand, but God, does God accept or reject me? How do I know? And what gets him questioning, you see, is verse 2 explains it. It is the same for all, since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, and on along this list, the good and the bad. It's to say, I can't tell whether God is pleased with me or not by what happens to me in this fallen, broken world under the sun. Like my circumstances, I'm trying to figure it out. But both believers and unbelievers, the righteous and the wicked, the same event happens to everyone. Believers and unbelievers get cancer, die in car wrecks, get mugged, lose their jobs, suffer natural disasters. Circumstances can't be the gauge. He's trying to figure it out by what he observes and sees under the sun, and he doesn't know by what he's observed whether he is in the hands of God as if fallen into the hands of the living God, or whether he's in the hands of God as if kept safe in Jesus's and the Father's hands so that nothing can snatch him out. And circumstances don't tell you. And the fact is gut-wrenching for the preacher. He exclaims, and this is evil. I don't like it. But right there, when he expresses his angst and his outrage over that fact of life under the sun, it also speaks volumes about who we are. Because we have been created for these questions, created for justice. In chapter 3, eternity has been implanted in our hearts. It just begs for more information. Well, then the preacher compounds this disturbing condition by plunging down in the pit of fallen humanity, saying in verse 3, but our hearts are full of evil and madness all our lives until we die. And he's just saying the root of all of our problems that we're dealing with in this world is our rebellion and sin, our fall into sin, our choosing to revolt against God. And that fall into sin has caused another thing that we can depend on. Not only are we in God's hand, but we can also depend on something else due to sin, and that is our death. And that's really the event that happens to all, the good or the bad. So one commentator calls death the great leveler. Another calls it the universal obliterator. There's no easy way to make it sound any better, no matter who you are, that is your end. No matter if you lived well or poorly, one day you got a date with death. And that reality just disturbs him. And again, see, it's not just the fact of death, but it's the way it comes at us, irrespective of how you live your life, regardless of whether you are righteous, wisdom, and serve God well. So what do we do about it? Well, in verse 4, the preacher gives a partial answer. He says, while you're alive, you're joined to the living, you still have hope. Well, then he underscores that with a proverb. Even though a lion is much more majestic than a dog, you'd much prefer a living dog than a dead lion. Life is that much more preferable to death. And why is that in this context? Because if you're alive now and you face up to reality, then you can prepare for your death while there's still opportunity. That's what he's pushing us to. And then he stresses how important this is by going down deeper into the darkness. And the point in those verses 5 and 6 isn't to deny the afterlife, or verse 10 isn't to deny the afterlife. He's affirmed that in other places in Ecclesiastes. The point is to describe how dead death is. from the standpoint of under the sun, what you observe, it's over. The person's earthly life is done. All they've thought about, all they've achieved, all their big emotions like love and hate and all of that, it's all over. There's no more opportunity. So given that reality, right now is the time to prepare. You can depend on being in God's hand. You can depend on death. And so those two realities together, as he observes it under the sun, what it cries out for is more revelation. I want more information. I want to know God and I want to understand his promises. Ecclesiastes gives us the question for which the rest of the Bible gives us the answer. I need the gospel. Two, the struggle over what you can't depend on. Now we're jumping to verse 11. It's not only what you can depend on that's unsettling, but it's also what you can't depend on that's disturbing. The preacher sets out, as Derek Kidner says, three hazards of life. Three hazards. The first is verse 11. It's the hazard of ability. Well, he says in verse 11, you know, it's not your, you know, we tend to depend and bank on our speed, our strength, our wisdom, our intelligence, and our knowledge. We cultivate these. We work on these, and we do so to ensure the good life, success and security and satisfaction, our ability and our hard work. Throw our gifting into the mix. We tend to live and think, if I outpace others, overpower others, outthink others, then I will necessarily get a better outcome than others. I'll have a better life. And oftentimes, the ordinary way is that that does help. It's just that there are far too many exceptions and factors in this unsettled life under the sun to depend on that. You can't. It's a hazard. I mean, the increase, the drastic increase in sports betting tells us that it's not just the stronger, better team that's going to win every time. There's other factors in the works. The preacher would say it this way: time and chance happen to all. It's unpredictable and inexplicable. Second, verse 12, the hazard of awareness. Awareness. So we can get lulled into sleep and think tomorrow is going to be just like today. The preacher says, watch out. Things can come at us out of nowhere, out of the blue. A fish, if he knew that he was swimming into a net, he'd turn around and go the other way. If a bird noticed he was walking into the snare, he would fly off. But the fact is they don't, and they're trapped and they're caught. The point is, an evil time comes at us all of a sudden when we don't expect it. What we tend to think happens to other people, turns out it happens to us too. Third, verses 13 through 16, the hazard of appreciation. We oftentimes depend on others' favorable opinion and regard for us. And the preacher's just saying, you can't do it. People forget and people are fickle. This powerful, ruthless, covetous king comes against a little city. All appears lost. However, the value of wisdom, there's this poor, wise man in that city who makes all the difference. He does something to figure out how to deliver that hopeless city. But it makes you indignant that we have to admit it does happen. Once the city is rescued, no one remembers the poor wise man. Life goes back to business as usual. People revert back to judging by appearances. He's overlooked and unthanked. You can't count on that. With all that, however, the preacher, in the midst of the bad news, wants to give us the good news of how to live well. So he praises wisdom. He says, wisdom is better than might. So do we believe that? He says, quiet, wise words are better than foolish shouting. Are we those who want to control a situation by just over-talking, or those with quiet, thoughtful words? He says, wisdom is better than weapons of war, even those funny little weapons we use in relationships. He says, Wisdom is better than that. However, a caveat in this fallen world under the sun, one sinner destroys much good. It just happens. It happens. We experience it. Sometimes that's us. So again, we can't depend on our ability, our awareness, the appreciation of others, that is, our gifting and work ethic, our planning for the future, nor the opinions and high regard of others. All is uncertain. So what do we do then? If all is uncertain, do we go into our bedroom, turn the lights off, get under the covers, and binge watch Netflix? I mean, do we just shut down? Do we start popping edibles? Take the edge off. That's not the answer, by the way. Third point, the significance of what we can do right now, verses 7 through 10. Again, the whole point of the preacher pressing is taking off the rose-colored glasses, taking off dream world and putting real world is that he wants to show us the real meaning of life and then encourage us to live well. Really, in the real world, live well. What does it look like? Well, sandwiched between the two depressing sections is this carpe diem passages. And some people have carpe diem in their homes. So it's the seize the day passage. And I love it. Like he's swirling in this darkness and yet he comes up for air and hangs his hat on five different passages where he talks about these beautiful, ordinary life. This is the fifth one. And some commentators assert that these carpe diem passages, given that Ecclesiastes is dark, that they're just this resigned, anesthetizing pleasure, eking out some semblance of temporary enjoyment in the sad world before it's all over, making the best of a bad situation. I don't think that's right. I don't think that does justice to what the preacher's doing. I think it's overly cynical and short-sighted. He's given us the bad news to give us the good news of living life well. The main reason for this positive, more robust view of these five passages is that in all five of them, if you go through them, God takes center stage. Like oftentimes you have these gaps where God doesn't show up. These five passages, God is wrapped up in them. He's gone above the sun. And now it's made ordinary life worthwhile and significant. With God in the center, a perspective of God, we eat and we drink, we work because it's God's good gift to us. It comes from a gracious hand to you. So if we need a simple motto, David Gibson's is good. View life as gift, not gain. Or Zach S. Swine, view life as your lot is his gift. And receive it as a gift. Lift your eyes above the sun and see God's presence and activity in the ordinary gifts he's given you. He's involved with you. And this, the fifth Carpe Diem passage, is the most emphatic of all. It's punctuated because the preacher turns advice into a command. It's an imperative. He says, he looks at you and says, in the midst of all that, go. Go eat your bread. Go drink your wine. Yes, wine. Go work. Somewhere he says work. For God has already approved what you do. All right, so that go language is like commission language. I think you can see Genesis 1, 26 through 28 behind that. Be fruitful and increase in number. Or I think you see the Great Commission behind that. Go into all the world and disciple the nations. It's commission language. God has already approved what you do. Doesn't give you carte blanche permission to do whatever you want to. Of course, it doesn't give you permission to convert food, drink, and work into idols? Of course not. You're receiving them as gifts of God. He's approved of them because he's looking at you and saying, when you eat that lunch today, this is my gift to you. It's my gift of grace to you in this difficult world where you're living. And I want you to know my presence and activity with you. And another reason these passages should be viewed more positively, favorably, is as Zach Eswine says, and I just love this. It's helped my view of Ecclesiastes so much when he says, behind all these passages, you have to hear echoes of Eden, of working, of keeping, of eating, of marriage in the garden with the immediate presence of God in an unfallen world. We live in once Eden that's broken and fallen, but still gives glimpses and echoes of life as it was supposed to be. And as you engage in these activities by faith in God, received as a gift of his grace, in a way you're getting a glimpse and an anticipation and even moving, in a way, carrying forward God's plan for Eden recovered and restored. It's a call to faithfulness, to stand in a broken world, to tend your little gardens, all with a view towards God is what God is one day going to do. And the preacher keeps making it better. He goes on to say, let your garments be always white, let not oil be lacking on your head. In the midst of what is the most depressing chapter, he talks about dress up. Get those nice clothes. That's a sermon implication. Go to the party. Tailgate. Celebrate your birthday, your anniversary, your reunion. God is the author of festivity. A God of joy and delight who takes pleasure in your pleasure by faith in him. Not all sermon applications are urging you to do something you kind of don't want to do. Go to the party and enjoy yourself under the pleasure of God. And then notice the important addition. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life that he has given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. It applies to all of our relationships and friendships, but especially to marriage. Again, notice, married people, enjoy life with the wife whom you love. Not 1,000, if this is Solomon, but 1. It looks like Solomon wants a do-over. He would have liked to have done it a different way. And what it says is, bring Song of Solomon into this. Bring Genesis 2 into this. Bring Ephesians 5. Bring it all in. Enjoy the life with the wife whom you love. Enjoy each other. If you're not there, if you're going through a hard time in your marriage, he says, remember to love each other. That first and foremost is not gushing emotions, but it's laying your life down for each other. He's telling you to grow in your friendship. Spend time together. Appreciate the good. Give up your bitterness. Take that trip. Share that hobby. Cooperate in some project or ministry. Go to counseling. Get a third party involved. Share your heart. Admit to your big emotions. Get a work ethic on your marriage. Become relationally wise. Prioritize your romance. Yes, that's a sermon application. Verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. Doesn't that sound like Colossians 3? Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord, not for men, knowing that from the Lord you receive inheritance as your reward. The idea is as you engage in these, in devotion to God, you honor God, you change the world. And God even promises above and beyond the grace of salvation to reward his little ones in our imperfect, bumbling obedience. So the preacher brings it all down to ordinary things. There's a life he's given us, a portion, a people to love, regular needs, common opportunities, a million applications. Read that story to your children, load the dishwasher yet again, plug away at work, invite a neighbor over, take care of a family member, support a missionary, all with Jesus in mind. We can take it all for granted, but God is telling us here, I meet you here and I use you here. It's a gift of my grace to you, which means you're in my hand. And you see, Luke would tell us of the greater Solomon who came eating and drinking. He showed us the grace of the gospel by laughing and talking at a table. John would say, we're looking towards the marriage feast of the Lamb. You see, all of our ordinary activities in some sense anticipate redemptive realities. They all point above the sun and beyond the grave. So to those big questions, how do I know it's love and not hate when I'm in the hand of God? If God's given us the greatest gift, who was no ordinary gift, the Lord Jesus Christ, and it's the revelation the preacher's just aching for, if he gave us the greatest gift, the one that went all the way down into the pit of our fallen nature and the deadness of death, the judgment of God, the root cause of it all, down into our evil and into our madness, if he did that for us to lift us out of it and to bring us above the sun, if he did that, you see, he's the poor wise man, really. He's the poor wise man in the city besieged by the powerful, ruthless, covetous king. The city of mankind, or the city of your life. The evil one thought he had you captive. But the greater Solomon left all his riches behind in heaven. He was born in poverty, ministered as a homeless man, carried his cross outside a city, became utterly poor under the judgment of God for the purpose of satisfying the sentence of sin, then exploding death, resurrecting into glory, so that he might destroy the devil, death, and hell, and deliver you into glory. The question is, do we appreciate that? Like, do we recognize that? You see, faith in him were found in God's hand, not for hate, but for love. And the gospel tells of that, assured of his love, guaranteed of solid hope, free to serve, knowing nothing is vain. And that's the wisdom of the gospel. It's a hope that Solomon was inching towards but didn't quite have, because he hadn't seen the wisdom of God unveiled in the gospel yet, and we have. And you step out in the world with all its uncertainties and with the certainty of death and saying, I'm held in the hand of the Father and the Son, and nothing can snatch me out. So I can go eat, drink, work, and love, and know that God uses that for his glory. May God bless you today. Amen. Let's stand.